Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome back to our study of Christianity for Modern Pagans. We're going to be picking up with a new chapter today, chapter 10, which is titled Alienation, Lost in the Cosmos. I think it's a great chapter and obviously a theme we're all going to resonate with to one degree or another. The only difficulty here is that this is an extremely long pensée with lots of commentary. I think he goes through the alphabet on his notes of commentary, starting with A and ends at W. So we've got our work cut out. I'll skip around a little bit. I've tried to curate the commentary to the most important parts. There's a lot of good stuff, though. So we'll do the best we can. But let's have our invocation prayer, and we'll jump in on page 120. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. All right, top of page 120, Alienation, Lost in the Cosmos. This seems to be a wholly modern phenomenon, Kraft writes. Although some of the ancients felt detached from the world, they didn't feel alienated from it. For their science had not yet reduced it to something out of all proportion and relation to the human spirit. The pre-scientific picture of nature was always anthropomorphic. The most popular and lasting image of nature was that of a mother. Mother nature is a monomyth. When science seemed to show that nature was not a mother but a machine, not a womb, but a Skinner box, her children became anxious. Of course, science proved no such thing. Reductionistic and materialistic philosophies are the villains here, not science. Bacon, Locke, and Hobbes, not Galileo, Copernicus, and Newton. Science no more proves that nature is not a mother, but only matter, then an x-ray proves that a woman is not a mother, but only a bag of bones. Okay, good. So you can probably already see where this is going. A meditation on what the Enlightenment, empiricism, scientism have done to our view of the world, which an ultimate retrospect is a thing that was a bad trade. So we'll get into the argumentation here. Ponce 199, page 120. Disproportion of man. Before going on to a wider inquiry concerning nature, I want him to consider nature just once, seriously and at leisure, and to look at himself as well and judge whether there is any proportion between himself and nature by comparing the two. All right, that takes us to our first comment, and I'm sorry for how awkward this is, but we're going to flip back to 126. We're just going to have to do a bunch of flipping back and forth because I think this is the most profitable way to read. The other thing would be to go straight through the pensée and then straight through the commentary, but I think that makes for a muddle. So on page 126, comment A, the typical modern, in a hurry to be off and running with his science, forgets his philosophical perspective, inchworm, inchworm, measuring the marigolds, ignores the philosophical question of the fundamental relation between the mind of man, the measurer, and the material, marigolds, nature, whatever is measured. The modern mind was born when Bacon trumpeted man's conquest of nature. So Francis Bacon, 1561 to 1626, he's the father of empiricism, pioneer of the modern scientific method, which he thought men could use to subjugate the world And this, of course, is credited with giving birth to much of the Enlightenment thinking. So as Kraft has already said, he views Bacon as a kind of enemy, as one of those who laid the foundation for our feeling of being lost in the cosmos, and making modern man in a worse state than pre-modern man. Okay, so he says, the modern mind was born when Bacon trumpeted man's conquest of nature as the new summum bonum. So that's the great good, that's the arch aim of what it means to be a human being, and perhaps even in a sense the sum total of human destiny, that man would dominate nature. Obviously that's oriented in exactly the wrong way. As Christians, we know that our summum bonum is to dwell with God and to enjoy him and his grace and his goodness forever. So that orients us upward. The conquest of nature orients us downward. All right, Crave continues. Nearly everyone hopped on his bandwagon, but not Pascal. Today, nearly everyone can plainly see that Pascal was right and Bacon was wrong. That man's conquest of nature by science and technology, despite its spectacular success, has not made us happier, has not made us wiser, and has not made us holier. It has not even made us more powerful. The individual feels a far greater sense of impotence today than ever before. The question Pascal remembered and the founders of the modern mind forgot is the question of whether there is any proportion between the new, modernly conceived human mind and the new, modernly conceived material universe. The new mind is a calculator rather than a poet and prophet, a technocrat rather than a contemplator. And the universe is a lifeless, mindless, purposeless machine. Okay, so I think we can skip the last paragraph, but you see Crave's meditation here is that what has gotten exchanged for what amounts to a lot of modern conveniences, technologies, and trinkets is really a big deal. Man has lost his status as a kind of poet and prophet in creation, who is receiving from God through the cosmos, contemplating it, enjoying it, living and moving and being in harmony with it. And instead, he's been shrunk all the way down to a calculator with a scientific method. And all the crass expressions of that. And he no longer views the universe with wonder and awe. In fact, he feels ashamed to do so, because science tells him it's just there, it's just matter, it's not that big of a deal. And in any case, your mind is here to calculate it, to measure it, to dominate it, to twist it to your ends. And so the universe itself becomes lifeless, mindless, purposeless machine. This is going to be fleshed out. In a sense, this is just the whole thesis, so I don't want to overdo it with commentary, because this is going to get fleshed out quite a bit over the next few pages. Okay, anything you want to discuss here at the opening salvo, as it were? Yes, sir.
There seems to be a lot of irony here, and you could go down numerous rabbit holes, and I don't want to do that, but I just want to observe that it seems to me that, generally speaking, it's the non-Christians that are more concerned about, in a bad sense, the planet, the earth, the environment, you know, baby seals, you name it. But they're the most restless and worried about their future.
Right.
You know, and they just have the completely wrong perspective on how to take care of the planet and where it is in relation to the important things in life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great observation and interesting, you know. As Christians, we want to be stewards of creation, but we clearly see that, you know, our stewardship of God's creation flows from the fact that there is a God, and he made it, and it's gift, and it's stewardship, and it's respect, and so that's the proper proportion. when you lose God and you have just stuff, it is a strange kind of jarring dissonance where all of a sudden, but I guess Paul predicts it, you become infatuated with the creature rather than the creator, and thus turn that into a kind of religious expression. Yeah, we've got to do more for the environment, they type from their iPhone while sitting in a car that's driven by batteries that are mined from the just, you know, the absurdity, right? Yes, sir.
I think the question for us is, would any of us go back to the time of Bacon or something like that? You know, and you could go look at the Amish today. They really depend on technology to an extent. They pretend they don't, but yeah, they do. And I like when you go back to the Amish country, I like that they have battery-lit lights on the backs of their wagons to keep from getting hit. You know, it's okay to have a battery there. But at any rate, I don't think they're any happier than we are, or...
Yeah, I don't know. And I don't know that Crave's point is it called a Luddite when you're against, yes, technology? Yeah, I don't think Crave's point is that Ludditism is the way. Just that we look at a macro picture, and what we see is a shift in the way that the ancients, I mean, for many hundreds of years, if not thousands, the way that the ancients viewed themselves within creation, and the way they viewed creation itself. And there's a kind of, even just expressed in the language they use, there's an awe and a wonder and a kind of comfort and a sense of, I'm native here. You know, that's over generalizing, to be sure. But relative to where we are now, where, again, think of sense and light, the Enlightenment, and sense the dawn of scientism, you know, how we're told there's a Big Bang that's bazillions of years ago, and we're all just sort of stardust, and we all will return to stardust, and the world is expanding, and there's a million and one ways in which we're going to die, but don't worry, it's a billion years from now, and you look out, and space is completely expanding, and it's mostly empty, and there's no way to ever plumb its depths, and the whole modern view of the cosmos is one of isolation and loneliness and darkness and despair and heat death over time as you just grow colder and colder. And it's odd to see the way the modern mind, it's jarring to see the way the modern mind conceives of the cosmos relative to the ancient mind. And especially if you sort of say, well, let's judge between the post-Enlightenment and the pre-Enlightenment perspective. So that's largely the thesis here. It's not so much that the technology is to be avoided as it is, like, that's often the justification, right? It's like, hey, yeah, well, we took this turn after the Enlightenment, and we dove headlong into scientism. We lost the whole cosmos. We're more depressed than ever. We no longer understand ourselves as poets or prophets. We view ourselves as accidental dust particles here for a second and gone the next. But it's okay because we've got iPhone and fast food, and you can race around in a car while you are here. Like, that's the critique, is that it's a poor trade-off. Yeah.
Yes, so is the argument then not against the scientific method itself, but correct, rather with the results of it?
No, not even that.
Okay.
Yeah, as this unfolds, the scientific method itself is fine. I mean,
right.
And it's completely in harmony. What the critique is that the scientific method coupled with skepticism destroys all other knowledge except for this one narrow little slice. And then because we can't actually bear that one narrow little methodology, it gets expanded way beyond its proportion with to religious degree, which is where we're at today. I mean, Crafe's writing decades ago, but it's where we're at today, where people will just say, trust the science. And there's they're not talking it. I mean, they are a million miles away intellectually from the scientific method as such, right? Oh, you don't believe that that was from the Cretaceous period, however many hundreds of years, millions of years ago I just invented? Well, you got to trust the science, bro. It's like that is a long way off from the scientific method, isn't it? Right?
That's just a religion at a certain level.
Absolutely. And that's the sleight of hand, right? Is that we, being sort of the West, generally speaking, were sold a bill of goods. And so much of religion was erased, so much, and Christianity, I mean, was erased because it doesn't stand up to the scrutiny of this one specific method, the scientific method. And so it's wholesale abandoned. You get these projects of demythologizing Christianity, Rudolf Bultmann, this idea that if there's anything miraculous in the Bible, it has to be explained by natural phenomena. So this just ruling of this one very narrow, very specific methodology. And the justification for that has been like, but look what we've discovered about the world, and look what technologies we've invented, and now we've got vaccines. The same mentality that when it continues on is like, yeah, but now you've got vaccines that are also being manipulated by the CIA for population control purposes. I mean, as this information is now coming out publicly. So I think the critique is going to be, how did we get where we are today, where we think that where we think of the world in such a different way than the ancients? And maybe as Christians, you've experienced this to one degree or another too, where like you open the Bible and maybe you're tempted to feel embarrassed by the biblical worldview or biblical cosmology relative to what you learned in science class, or relative to what you hear online, or quote unquote scientists saying. So this chapter will diagnose that problem and then hopefully steer us on a better course. There's a hand up here. I don't know if there was one first back there. Okay, a couple hands. Yeah.
I'm wondering, how do you weave aliens, the possibility of aliens into Christianity?
Yeah. I mean, there's one real easy way that when you talk about the descriptions given of aliens and especially of alien abductions and all this stuff, they virtually overlap 100% with accounts present and ancient in regard to demonic activities. So I think about 99% of that, if it's legitimate, is demonic. And otherwise, you're talking about like some kind of strange natural phenomenon that's just not known. Now, if you did want to like ask the question, like hypothetically, if we were to discover definitively that there was sort of animal life or something on some other planet, I don't know how that would disturb the Christian worldview. I mean, I wouldn't give me a crisis of faith. Somebody would have to like tell me why I should have a crisis of faith over that, because I don't, the Genesis account, I don't know that it's completely exclusive. It talks about the creation. It talks about how God created life on the earth. It doesn't really, to me, answer the question as to whether he might have created life on other planets. So I would look at that as just ambiguous data, right? I mean, I don't know. Maybe somebody else has given it more thought than me. Yes, sir.
Real quick. I think that, especially me included in this, people have a view of the ancient world that is very against the present. Like, we're better than the ancient world.
Yeah, 100%.
And I don't know if that's totally true.
It's not.
Like, there's so many smart, like, genius people from that time that we even should still look up to and read today to gather information from. And to just discredit them because they didn't have smartphones and speakers and microphones, like, that feels so disingenuous.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like the temptation with the scientific method is, well, look at how smart I am because of all this research I've done. So I can discredit the people that came before me.
Yeah, exactly. We're gonna see Crafe draw some of that out. And already, even just in his kind of teaser / intro on the top of page 120, you sort of see this. It's like, while man certainly knows more, paradoxically, he knows even less. It's like, you know, you can look through a telescope, we objectively have more information, that kind of thing. In that sense, our knowledge has expanded. But the worldview that's gone along with that has actually stripped us of knowledge of what God's design and purpose are in creation. I mean, God doesn't create calculators. He creates people to look up at the sky and marvel and receive it as his gift and his grace, to see in the heavens the signs of his handiwork and the signs of time and season, and to marvel and explore and learn and speculate and discover even more about the creator through the creature. But, you know, scientism really strips all that away. And it's just me and material. It's the empirical knowledge of my senses. It's my rationality. It's and then, of course, in Bacon, it's even so that I can gain control over creation and manipulate it unto my end, speaking collectively for mankind. So that mentality shift comes at a great cost. So, the ancients might have less knowledge than us, objectively speaking, and yet be more knowledgeable as to the true nature of creation. That's going to be one of the points that Kraft teases out. Okay? Good. Barry, please.
Just a quick thought. American Indians, the natives, they seem to look to nature, and they found a lot of, their medicine men and so forth. And they did Christianity ever penetrate them? In other words, you know, Romans 1 talks about it's evident that man can see God in nature. Well, it seemed like it was zero effective with the Native American Indians. Would you agree with that, or could you comment on, if that's true, why it wasn't effective with them?
Boy, I just don't know enough. Let me make sure I'm understanding the question first. Is the question why, broadly speaking, in Native American cultures, it seems as though the natural knowledge of God is less or non-existent, or what, is that the question you're asking?
Right, in the context of this, upon say, they were absorbed into the materialism and into creation instead of being stewards over it and seeing it as God's goodness and God's blessing to them. They didn't see Almighty God. They saw forces and solutions.
Yeah. So that is kind of the dark side. If I could broaden the conversation, because as I was going to say, I'm just not that knowledgeable about the specifics of Native American culture in general. I mean, I have probably a broad, you know, but if you take this outside of that to more broadly the pagan mind, so I think it's a great point that you're bringing up, because we don't want to romanticize the pre-Enlightenment, you know, mentality as a whole. But the difference is, you know, we have a tendency to look at creation. You know, you're driving down the freeway and you look out and it's just, you kind of see desolation, right? You know, we don't see resources. We don't see, we certainly don't see like spiritual things. We don't see connection to the spiritual world with the physical. We're not pondering these things. We tend to just like, okay, well, here's the freeway, there's the gas station, there's Target if I need it. When we look at nature, about the most modern man tends to look at nature, he's like, oh yeah, that's beautiful, you know, great. But there's not much more than that. So when you're comparing that to the pre-Enlightenment or even some non-Western peoples, they just view nature very much differently. They view it as a kind of spiritual place, and there's all kinds of spiritual interconnections. Now, as Christians, we know that that ties into the larger biblical narrative, God and angels of many and various kinds and demons of many and various kinds, and a completely spiritually permeated reality in which we live. Now, when you're talking about pagans, they're seeing that, but they're just tending to see the worst parts of that, the fallen parts of that, and they're worshiping those things as gods that aren't gods and are in fact demons. And so you get this kind of animism or manifestation, well, or shamanism in whatever culture, the use of pharmakeia, the use of hallucinogens to tap into the gods is almost universal through, everything from alcohol to marijuana to all manner of strong hallucinogens are used in all cultures as religious gateways into the spiritual world. So, right, it doesn't, I mean, just because we're in this sort of post-Enlightenment scientific worldview, if we blast back as best we can to that pre-Enlightenment worldview where the spiritual is everywhere and permeates everything, we're still a step away from seeing that world accurately, the way the Bible describes. So pagans are going to have that worldview, but it's going to be warped and twisted, and they're going to participate in ways that are displeasing to God. Am I in the ballpark here or no?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I think Paul addressed this when he went into Athens. You know, he addressed them. He says, "You worship all of these, but there's that one unknown God that they had covered." So I'm thinking also of Romans 10, where Paul says, unless someone is sent who preaches, mm-hmm. faith can't be created. So it just seems like we haven't either gone into and evangelized the Native Americans, but it seems like it's a black hole that I don't know whether Christianity exists in those tribal nations here within our country. So I just wanted to leave it at that.
Yeah, I mean, Paul's claim in the early chapters of Romans is that God has left himself a sufficient witness within creation that man is without excuse. Now, that seems to be the main point that he's trying to make, is that man is accountable and without excuse. And everything that's downstream from that is downstream of his rejection of that. Obviously, there's going to be more nuance and complication involved, even when you look at something like what God says in Exodus in the context of the Ten Commandments, punishing the children for the sins of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. So that's always yet another kind of variable when you're looking at people groups is, okay, well, this is generally what we know about them, what happened generations earlier, generations still earlier. In many cases, it would seem too like Native American and Southern American cultures seem in many respects to be very similar to Babylonian culture and or ancient Greek culture, where even things like the building of the mounds or the ziggurats and the connection, I mean, the whole just religious structure seems to have a kind of common denominator to it. The use of pharmakeia, the use of human sacrifice, these kinds of phenomenon are, you know, once you kind of have a view, it's like, okay, well, the only difference is you're calling the god this versus that, but it's essentially the same structure or essentially the same worldview operating. Okay, so let's jump back into the text, page 120. And we're going to enter into this next paragraph. And I think what I'm going to do is... just read a little ways past B, and then we'll circle back to the comment at B. Let man then contemplate the whole of nature in her full and lofty majesty. Let him turn his gaze away from the lowly objects around him. Let him behold the dazzling light set like an eternal lamp to light up the universe. Let him see the earth as a mere speck compared to the vast orbit described by this star, and let him marvel at finding this vast orbit itself to be no more than the tiniest point compared to that described by the stars revolving in the firmament. But if our eyes stop there, let our imagination proceed further. It will grow weary of conceiving things before nature tires of producing them. All right, let's jump back now and get the comment on B, contemplating the whole of nature. Kraft has just this brief comment that nature is the universe, so this whole meditation is on the cosmos, whereas the world is referring to planet Earth. So just this idea of let's take in the whole cosmos, and then you start to get introduced to one of the major themes when he's talking about letting our imagination proceed further. So imagination is the tool that's really been replaced by calculation. And so obviously to just make something complicated overly simple, one could see this pensée as a call to return to imagination that is enlightened by the revelation of God. So man's imagination will grow weary of conceiving things before nature tires of producing them. And whereas maybe the scientific mindset would teach us like, well, those kinds of imaginations and speculations are foolish and childish and to be dismissed. They don't have value. They don't progress or progress you in your technology. Pascal would be calling that scientific view into question and saying, this is like the bread and butter of what it means to be a human being. To enjoy the cosmos and creation and to enjoy imagination and your interplay with what God has set before you. That's like the whole thing. You're gonna trade that in for this specific, narrow, and dogmatic method.
I just think because the world has gotten so complicated, and even when I used to be a school teacher with my children and what I was expected to set up for goals in what they're supposed to learn and whatever, we have become very uncomfortable. I leaned over and said to my husband, with the word wonder. Mm-hmm. We have lost, which implies imagination. Mm-hmm. We want answers, and we've been trained that that's the only, you know, and when I'm deciding what bank to put my money in or what, you know, I want the answer.
Yeah.
But we've forgotten how to wonder.
Yeah.
And we're not comfortable with not having answers, and we need to go back. The arts, that's why the arts should never be separated out of formal schooling, mm-hmm. because the arts are more accepting of wonderment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they have tools that they use, and yes, you can make green by combining yellow and blue, but you still have a lot of ability to wonder when you're in one of those classes.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, and that's probably a kind of natural revelation in itself, but also the Bible works just this way. That the Bible, God's self-revelation, is sure there's content to know, and it's good, and the more, but that's not the end goal. The end goal isn't to know all the stuff. The end goal is to know God and marvel at His goodness, and the Bible as God's revelation has that same dynamic as creation, where ultimately you realize that you can't know it all, and it'd be sort of fruitless to even try. You're missing the point. The point is to enjoy and to wonder and to marvel. So, yeah, thank you for that. Was there another? Yes, please.
Maybe this is too simple, but there are Christian scientists or in the science community who are believers, and they are starting to discover more and more that all science really is pointing towards a creator and that the Bible is true and real. Mm-hmm. So is it too simple to say that man essentially will find what he seeks? So I think you touched on it a little bit in your homily this morning, that if you humble yourself and you seek God, he'll reveal himself. But if you say, well, I know all the answers, I can be God, I'm going to look for answers to prove that I know more than God and that he doesn't exist, he hides himself even more. Is that too simple?
That's a great way of putting it.
I mean, that's maybe what's happening in science today, is we think we can be God. And so man runs after, oh, well, there's an iPhone. So, of course, mm-hmm. you know, I'm so smart. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's just too simple thinking.
No, I think it's a great reflection. It's a great reflection. And I think ultimately Pascal and Kreeft are going to take us there, with the fear of the Lord being the beginning of wisdom. And often, like, scientism is beginning with there is no God, to fear. And then whatever other things might be produced, wisdom is not the word to describe it. So, and then the idea that modern man would be sort of puffed up by that over and against religion is just all the more egregious. I mean, to be expected, but all the more egregious. And then I like your perspective too, because I think it's objectively correct. Scientism, post-enlightenment, empiricism, rationalism, scientism had its day in the sun, but that the sun is quickly setting on all of that. And I mean, I even as you said, there are voices in mainstream science that are returning to, well, there has to be a creator. And that may even be a far cry away from Christianity yet, but just there has to be a creator. Design describes what's happening better than some theory that there is no creator, no one who set things in motion. So, yeah, thank you for that comment. Okay, any other thoughts? Let's hit the top of 121, and we're going to try to sweep through all three of these notes and then descend back into those notes. So the top of 121, the whole visible world is only an imperceptible dot in nature's ample bosom. No idea comes near it. It is no good inflating our conceptions beyond imaginable space. We only bring forth atoms compared to the reality of things. Nature is an infinite sphere. And obviously, Crave's going to call that into question. Nature is an infinite sphere whose center is everywhere and circumference is nowhere. In short, it is the greatest perceptible mark of God's omnipotence that our imagination should lose itself in that thought. All right, well, I mean, even just superficially, you can take from this a kind of wonderful reality that the universe has many centers. I mean, technically an infinite number of centers, but this is part of the imagination. There are various centers of the universe, even in your own life. You're one. The whole world, the whole universe, the whole cosmos is perceived through you. And I mean, this is obviously exploited in some cheesy ways, but in a sense, every human being contains within himself an entire cosmos, a conception of God and everything else, a conception of the whole universe. So a person can be a center of the universe. A family can be a kind of center of the universe. A church can be a center of the universe. In fact, quite arguably, that is the model of the local congregation that we've lost touch with in our that we've lost touch with in our modern consumeristic age, where, you know, it's all this whole view is just utterly destroyed when you can get up and go wherever you prefer the music or wherever you prefer the, you know, the aesthetic. But where you have like one church in a township or one church to which you can go, that is the church, the whole church. That is the church right there. That is, in a sense, in a very real sense, the center of the universe, Christ and his people gathered in that particular place. And that's even reflected in our liturgical language, that we're gathering with angels and archangels and the whole company of heaven. It's why effectively what John sees in Revelation maps right over the top of the local congregation. So anyway, that's just to kind of, I don't know, give maybe some of my own thoughts and meditations on this point, albeit in a very superficial way. If we turn back to, we're going to try to hold these things in our minds, but we're going to turn back then to page 127, and we'll just grab some of the commentary here. So here was to your point earlier, that we discredit the ancient mind in ways we shouldn't. That's point C on 127. It was well known throughout the Middle Ages that the universe was unimaginably vast. Ptolemy, he is a second century AD philosopher. Ptolemy had already taught that in his Almagest, which was the authoritative astronomy text before Copernicus, Copernicus 1473 to 1543. So, it's remarkable because the Ptolemaic view of the cosmos held sway for 1300 years or whatever. And it's even the view that Luther largely operates under in his commentaries. But in any case, Ptolemy and Copernicus will both show you quite sophisticated understandings of the cosmos. All right, picking up after that semicolon on the fourth line, and Boethius had popularized this teaching in the Consolation of Philosophy. Boethius is between the 5th and 6th centuries, 480 to 524. The Consolation of Philosophy, which is more widely read than any, was more widely read than anything except the Bible and Augustine's Confessions and City of God. The notion that the medieval universe was small and cozy and not awesomely vast is simply false. This false idea has become enormously popular because, again, what even is the language of the Enlightenment? Well, if we had to be enlightened, we were in the Dark Ages, so these people understood nothing and knew nothing, and so we're debunking that. This false idea has become enormously popular and embedded in the contemporary mind, which repeats secondary sources as authoritative without knowing or respecting the primary sources, much more authoritarianly than the Middle Ages did. So, yeah, I mean, Kraft sees the Enlightenment as the Endarkenment and frequently points out the ironies involved. Okay, D, this famous description was well known to the Middle Ages. So that is the description that nature is an infinite sphere whose center is everywhere and circumference is nowhere. This famous description was well known to the Middle Ages. It comes from Pseudo-Dionysius. He's a late 5th, early 6th century author, and an extremely important author for theology and for philosophy. Comes from Pseudo-Dionysius the Areopagite and describes God, not nature. The fact that Pascal now applies it to nature is a shocking and fascinating change. Nature now elicits the religious awe that only God had elicited in the Middle Ages. There seems to be an obvious connection between modernity's divinizing nature and its naturalizing God. Both these things happen when you stand upside down. Yeah, so that's the irony too, is that material is everything. So in that sense, it's divine, and nature is, and God is nothing. So therefore, he's naturalized and localized to, oh, the invention of this people group or that people group. All right, E. In Pascal, as in the Middle Ages, the vast size of the universe is used to show forth the vastness of God's power. The very same fact is commonly used by the modern mind, which ignorantly thinks it is the first to discover the fact, as evidence for atheism. Okay, so that's an interesting thing. Take the vastness of the universe, and that tends to be one of the atheists' arguments. Not a good argument, it's based on feeling, but the idea is, look how vast this is, and here we are on this tiny little speck, and we're tiny little specks amongst trillions of people, and you think God cares about you. There's no such God. There's no such thing. Now, the ancients took that same data, the vastness of the universe, the vastness of the human race, the smallness of the planet, the smallness of the individual, and they saw in that rather a testimony to God's greatness and his awesomeness and his wonder, that he can be God and fully God to every individual, God and fully God to every planet, to every speck of dust, and yet control the whole thing and weave the whole thing together wonderfully. So they took the same data and delighted in God, and their imagination was enlightened. Whereas modern man looks at that data and wields it against God to try to make God and Christianity seem absurd. Okay, so that's a spiritual phenomenon, not necessarily a data phenomenon. So just picking back up on that fifth line under E, and I think he's quoting here the modern scientist or scientific mind, how could you believe in a God when man is but a lost speck in an infinite abyss? Why the size of the universe should count against theism is never argued for, only assumed. For the argument is worthless or non-existent, but the feeling is strong. That's where the change takes place, in feeling, in sensibility. So thus the title of the chapter, Alienation Lost in the Cosmos, that most of mankind today feels alienated and lost in the cosmos and doesn't know what to make of it. And what he does make of it is that there couldn't possibly be the cozy Christian God. But as Kraft points out, that's a feeling, not an argument. So last three lines, it is a change from feeling at home to feeling lost. And from a universe full of signs that point beyond themselves to their author. And that's kind of what I was talking about, Barry, with you, and that even in the pagan conversation, they view the world as just permeated with signs and penetrated with spiritual realities in a way we don't. It's full of signs that point beyond themselves to their author, to a universe that is empty and silent. Yeah, so that's the modern notion of space. I mean, just even think of that language. Space is empty and silent. So Genesis 1:14 tells us that the stars and all the heavenly bodies are made specifically by God for us, for man, and for our enjoyment and for signs and wonders and the knowledge of time and the knowledge of the ordering of the cosmos. So the scriptures certainly speak directly to this point. And I think there's a quote from Lewis in his novel, Out of the Silent Planet, where he talks about the difference between just the modern conception of the cosmos embodied in that, the usage of that word space. It's just vast and empty and filled with space, versus the ancient way of speaking, and this is true for pagans and Christians, the ancient way of speaking as of what's up there as the heavens. So filled with God and or gods, small g gods, that's certainly within the biblical worldview, but permeated with spiritual beings all the way through and all the way up, and the stars and the other heavenly bodies, speaking to that reality as signs and symbols of it. Okay, any thoughts here on C, D, and E? Anything covered? All good? There's one.
Yeah, going back up to the evidence for them, how could you believe in a God when man is but a lost speck? Isn't this part of our condition as sinners, that we have this pain, constant nagging that, we're missing something?
Yeah, sure.
And this could be part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, believers are comforted with the knowledge of God and their salvation, but you still have moments,
yeah,
that are, oh my, what's going on,
yeah.
I don't know if I described that correctly, but isn't that just part of our condition?
Yeah, it is. And if you drill down to that, you'll find, only we as Christians can acknowledge this, but you'll find a kind of lack of faith, right?
Yeah.
And a kind of, yeah, something's twisted up, yeah. I mean, I think we have to wrestle to some degree on account of that sinful nature that doesn't trust God, that still kind of coheres to us, even though we've been regenerated by the Holy Spirit. That inner man has to battle the outer man from time to time. We have to mortify the flesh. These are all ways that Paul talks about it. So when you see the vastness of the cosmos or something like that, or the intricacy of nature, I mean, in one sense, the old man, especially post-enlightenment, wants to grab a hold of that and doubt and say, oh, look, it's just chaos and it's too big and it's unknown and there's and God seems implausible. Again, seems, feels. These aren't arguments, right? Yeah, and you are a speck. So, and I think you can struggle with that any time, because God is, sometimes you can think of that just even in terms of the vast number of human beings.
Yeah.
You think like it's, you know, I don't know, it can strike the old Adam with a sense of doubt of like, wow, how can we be significant? How can God care if there's so many of us? I mean, but that's not an argument, that's a feeling.
Yeah.
And the argument and the feeling flip on a dime under just the same data set when you go, God is so wonderful, he wants more and more and more, and he's utterly inexhaustible. And just because there's, if there's infinite people, he's no less God to each and every individual. That's something to marvel in. Just like if there's a million more people tomorrow, God isn't somehow diminished. Or his love for me or you isn't diminished. So the same data can drive us into a further love and wonder and awe at God. And so that's the wrestling that has to take place, right? To actually believe that God is so wonderful to create the universe the way he did, for man to marvel at him and to enjoy him and to contemplate and to feel that disorientation is great. But I think the other thing that all of this does, and it's framed properly by the inner man who knows and believes God and entrusts himself to God, is you realize the vastness of what's under God's control. And then you have to surmise from that the things I'm experiencing are small and not that big of a deal. And if he wants to fix them, it's well within his power to fix them. I mean, if he's running the whole cosmos, he can't adjust this or that in my life when I pray and ask him. So it's not that he can't.
It's that he must be laying this upon me for my good. And so then to receive it as his fatherly discipline, his loving care, the way he's admonishing and grows. In other words, it shrinks your problems. The bigger God is, the more it shrinks and contextualizes your problems, and the more you see that it's intentional and by his design, and that he who loved us so wonderfully in Christ Jesus, I mean, giving the only begotten, infinite, every bit as high as the Father, giving his Son to us and for us, how will he not also give us all good things? So it's, you know, it's interesting because the data doesn't change. If the old Adam's got a hold of it, it's terrifying and doubt causing and, you know. But the same data set is used by the inner man to come to the most comforting and sweet conclusions there are about God and to marvel at his goodness. So it's not the data that's the problem. It's the instrument that's reading the data. So just to recognize that within yourself and just know that the flesh is going to have its perceptions of these things, but so is the inner man. Yeah. Thank you. Yes, sir.
My question is this. If you take Jesus out of the equation,
yep.
Can other cultures be worshiping the same God that we worship?
I don't know what you mean if you take Jesus out of the equation, I guess. I don't.
Well, doesn't the Jewish population does not believe in that Jesus?
Oh, yeah, I think I see the point.
Okay, so there's one example.
Okay.
Do they believe in the same God we believe in?
Yeah, short answer is no. So what's happening is a kind of equivocation with language. So it works like this. The Jews say, well, we worship one God. Do you worship one God? And we say, yes, we worship one God. And then the Islam chimes in, yes, we worship one God too. Allah is just the name for God. So, yeah, we all worship God. And so we're all using the same word, God, but the equivocation is, what do you mean by God? How do you define that? And then a Christian's the only one that's going to say Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, or God became flesh and was crucified and raised again. So that's when you get to the brass tacks, right? Behind the equivocation of, oh, well, we all use the same word, or we all have the same definition of this concept. Only when you actually flesh that out do you see it's not true. So no honest imam or rabbi or a Christian theologian or pastor is going to say we worship the same God.
Some people would also throw in Native American beliefs and also, I don't know how to describe, but things like Freemasonry.
Yeah.
They acknowledge a great spirit.
Sure, right.
And
right.
They'll say, oh, well, it's all the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. And you've got... I mean, even like in Greek religion, the unknown God was brought up. I mean, that's probably a central core, ultimately Platonic, middle Platon, Platonism, late Platonism, Neoplatonism, Platonism. But they had this whole idea of the unknowable God. That's probably what Paul's tapping into. And it's like not always clear, depending on the philosopher, author, if this God is even conscious, right? But a common Greek idea is that there's one God, the one unknowable thing or entity above it all. So, yeah, I think this is very common. And I think probably that's what Paul would point to and say that's effectively demonstrating the natural knowledge that no matter how big the pantheon is, ultimately you've got one creator behind that. And that's even how, I mean, all the mythology is. Like, ostensibly, you might have, like, this pantheon of gods, whether it's in the Romans or the Greeks or the Babylonians. But ultimately, you've got one God that's, shall we say, more equal than the other gods, or one God that's the source of it, or there's some father figure who's from which the pantheon springs. And maybe he's even got, you know, some sort of lineage behind him, but the idea is there's always this highest, or at least highest in the present order. And so all of that speaks to this natural knowledge of God, yeah. Okay, next week, let's pick up 121. Looks like that first full paragraph. The Lord be with you.